So, the integumentary system, you know it as the skin. So something we see all the time. It's a fascinating organ. In fact, that's one of the old Trivial Pursuit questions. What's the largest organ in the human body is actually your skin. So we can see there's lots of stuff that goes on in here. Your skin has a lot, and it's the second one. I didn't list them properly in the... It's the second set. I should have been the first one, but it slipped down to the second position. So it should be the second set that you see there. Great. Okay. Then. Okay. So a lot of stuff going on here. So this is known as the skin system. Think of it as a coat that you wear. It's waterproof, washable, permanent press, repairs cuts, burns, rips invisibly, guaranteed to last a lifetime as long as you take care of it. So when we're talking in this set of lectures, we're talking about the system, which is the skin, and its accessory parts. So there are some accessory structures that do relate to the integumentary system. This is a really easy thing. I don't even know if it works anymore, but it's a little picture. If you put your cursor over top of it, any of the organs within the picture, it shows you all the various things that you can find in the skin. So it covers your whole body, has a surface area of approximately 1.5 to 2 square meters. If we took it all off, it accounts for about 7% of your total body weight. So it does have some mass to it, and it does have a bit of weight to it. So we can say there's all different shapes, sizes, lumps, bumps, colors, all sorts of things with skin. Now, I want you to think in your mind of a centimeter. How big is a centimeter? A square centimeter. Anybody got a ruler? Like, how big is a square centimeter? It's pretty tiny, right? Okay, think of that square centimeter. There are 70 centimeters of blood vessels in that square centimeter. There are 55 centimeters of nerves. There are 100 sweat glands. There are 15 oil glands. There are 230 different afferent sensory receptors that are measuring temperature, tickle, pressure, those sorts of things. And 500,000 cells that are constantly dying and being replaced in that square centimeter. So don't ever think for a moment when you lay hands on your patient that you're not affecting change of some kind. Touch, this is why touch is so powerful. Because of all of this, we affect a lot of change just simply by touching skin. There's a lot of other things we do, but skin will have an effect on the patient just simply because of this, right? Those afferent vessels and so forth. So the word integument means covering. So it's sort of this covering on us. And it helps in temperature regulation and water content regulation. In other words, its homeostatic responsibilities are your temperature and water retention. That's one of its whole purposes. It does vary in thickness, anywhere from 1.5 to 4 millimeters thick. So it can be quite thick, especially when you think of our feet sort of ideas, right? It's quite thick there. There is two layers to it. The most apical layer is known as the epidermis, right? So this is composed of epithelial cells. And then just below it is called the dermal layer or the dermis, and this makes up the bulk of the skin. It is leathery and is composed of fibrous tissue, and it lies deep to the epidermis. This is the layer that we make leather out of. Okay, so when animal hides are used to make leather, the epidermal layer is ripped off, the connective tissue underneath is taken off, and it's the dermal layer that we cure to create leather. And yes, you can make leather out of human skin. And some horrible guy did that. What's that? Yeah, so did the Nazis in concentration camps. They'd sell human skin lampshades. It's kind of scary. So we can see it's everywhere, and it changes throughout. It's different colors and so on and so forth. So when we compare the epidermis to the dermis, it's the dermis that's vascularized. So it's the one that's got the blood supply and so forth. The nutrients do reach the epidermal layer, but through diffusion from the dermis. So we're going to learn that the deepest cells of the epidermal layer are alive and actively dividing, and they require things for their metabolic needs, and that comes to them via diffusion from the deeper dermal layer. So it kind of feeds it through that diffusion. Below that, we have subcutaneous tissue, and this is called the hypodermis or superficial fascia. So now we think about it. We've got epidermis, dermis, then we have superficial fascia that's sort of below that, Now you're going to learn skin rolling next semester, those sorts of things, these connective tissue techniques that we can do. This subcutaneous tissue, though, is not considered to be part of the integumentary system. It's the deepest part, a different part of it. Within that deeper tissue, this is where we find that adipose plus some more areolar tissue. Has anyone ever cut themselves bad enough here that you've had white globs of fat come out of the wound? Yeah. Okay, it just means the way you've gone down to, that wound has gone down into this subcutaneous layer, and you do have released lipids that are blobbing out of the wound. It's usually a very serious cut most times when you see it. They get a little panicky when they kind of see that. Did you have your hand up, or are you just stretching? Okay. This is quite deep. The superficial fascia also anchors the skin to the underlying structures and allows the skin to slide. So it provides some of that strength that doesn't keep us from, by the time we're 50, our entire body of skin is kind of sitting down around her ankles like a pair of pantyhose on a Saturday night, right? The superficial fascia also, and some people know what I'm talking about. The superficial fascia also acts as an insulator and shock absorber. It is the superficial fascia, in most cases, that thickens when we start gaining weight, except for Uncle Bob, who's got the visceral fat from all the beer he drinks, and he's got the big ripe watermelon when you tap on his tummy, right? So again, lots of stuff going on in here. So let's do the epidermis first, that apical layer. And it can have anywhere from four or five layers depending on its thickness, okay? Actually, I was listening to that yesterday. I was watching golf, and Head and Shoulders has this new commercial, you know, they're all in the showers, and then, how deep do you think this can go? You know, you've seen that commercial, right? And they go seven layers deep, and I go, seven layers? Okay, there's five to the epidermis, maybe, and one dermis. So I don't know where the seventh one is yet. I haven't been able to figure it out. So it's suggesting that if you use Head and Shoulder, it goes all the way through your skin into your body. I don't know. So four layers. But also, there are four cell types. So there are common types of cells. If you remember from the lecture, epidermal tissue is all about cells, and connective tissue is all about Yeah, good call. Matrix and fibers. So it's one thing I always take away. When we look at the two dish tissues between epithelial and connective, epithelial is all about cells. How many, what shape, right? And they're usually pretty tightly packed together. When we look at connective tissue, remember there are a few cells but lots of matrix and ground substance between the cells. And within there, we find the fibers. And those fibers directly influence the type of connective tissue it is. Reticular fibers are collagen, very strong, powerful, or elastic, like your ear. You're able to pull your ear and twist it around and pops right back to where it started from because there's a lot of elastic fibers in that connective tissue. So epithelial, all about cells. Connective, all about matrix and fibers. Okay, so we say there are four types of cells here. Keratinocytes, melanocytes, Langerhans, and Merkels. So we can see here in this diagram, or it's actually a microscopic photograph, we can see that the epidermis has this upper part here. Now, why do you think these cells are empty? Because those are cells, right? They're dead. They are full of a protein called keratin, which we'll learn. This part here that's a bit pinker, or red, I guess I should say, you can see you have these fingers that extend down into the dermis. This still is the epidermis. And then the flesh color, if you want to call it that, is the dermis, which is the live part. So it is this dermis that has the blood supply and so forth, and then the epidermis gets, as I said, this very deep layer of cells are actively dividing, filling in the spaces of all these dead cells up here. And so we have diffusion that's occurring here that helps keep these cells alive. So up here on the top, you're tearing these cells off by the millions every day. As I said, one square centimeter, losing 500,000 cells in a day. So, and there's a deliberateness to that. So by the time the cells get up there, they know they're going to get sloughed off, okay? So let's do keratinocytes first. They make up the greatest percentage of cells in the epidermis, approximately 85%. They produce a protein called keratin. And what this does, it allows the skin to be strong and protective. So imagine, if you will, from a structure governs function point of view, you have this skin that's you on the outside, and it's vulnerable, right? You know, even putting on clothes, drying yourself off with a towel, so on and so forth, you're applying friction on it, shall we say microscopic trauma, and that skin needs to be able to stay intact. If you were to rub the inside of your cheek like you dry yourself off in the shower, what do you think would happen to the tissue in your cheek? You basically rub it all off. It's not the same kind of epithelial tissue. So it's deliberately there. This keratin makes these cells within this protein impregnation really, really, really strong. The cells protect underlying tissues from abrasions, heat, microbes, and chemicals. So in immunity, when we look at skin, the first line of defense is the fact that your skin's intact. When we have burn victims, the greatest danger for a burn victim is infection, because the skin integrity has been destroyed, which makes that open area opportunistic for anything that's floating in the air to land, and then these patients get terrible infections because their skin is not intact. So one of the first lines of defense is the fact that your skin is intact and covers everything. These keratinocytes are tightly connected by desmosomes, and these cells arise in the deepest part of the epidermis and stop dividing after reaching three layers from the dermis. So as I said, when they're very deep in the epidermis, they are dividing. As they travel apically, two or three layers away from that deep part, they're done. They don't divide anymore. They are not an active cell that's even able to divide in the first place. Please understand that when the cells are starting at the bottom and dividing, they have all the normal things a cell may have. As those cells start traveling apically towards the upper surface, they become impregnated more and more and more and more with keratin. So that by the time they get to the top, they're nothing more than a cell membrane and keratin. No more organelles, no more anything, just a cell membrane and keratin. Yes, and we'll talk about that. But how many of you here have had a really bad sunburn and peeled that snake skin off, right? That's a layer of epidermis. The next time you do it, take it up to the sun and you will see all the cells. They're all kind of there. You do not. You eat it? Okay. Well, you guys wait. One of the more enjoyable times as a massage therapist is you get the lotion on your hand, they've had a sunburn, you do your first effleurage, and you're just covered in their skin because it all just peeled off. Yeah, like the skin, that's right, exactly. Yeah, and you're just like scraping it off into the sink. Also, the keratinocytes produce what are called laminar granules, and they release a water-repellent sealant, a fat, that decreases water entry and loss. Your skin is not completely waterproof, but it's quite water-resistant. And so you've got keratin, which is helping it become waterproof, and then you have this little bit of lipid that just helps prevent a little bit more, makes it a little more water-resistant. So we can see the keratinocyte here. Now, yeah, it's counterintuitive. You're actually, through osmosis, water is actually leaving your skin. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it's one of those things that just gets kind of funky, and water is actually leaving your skin. So it's actually getting wrinkly. What's that? Maybe. It's quite possible. Yeah. I always get that question. Skin's one of those things everybody's got questions about, right? Yeah, you guys wait. You're going to get that gobby skin in your hands when you're treating this summer, when they've got sunburns or whatever. Yeah, exactly, right? It's like, so, when we look at the epidermis, the deepest layer, so what I do is I quite often use this as an imagination. So we've got all these blocks here, right? And we're going to say the ceiling is the most apical part, all the way down to the floor being the most basilar part, okay? So we're going to say, we're just going to take the epidermal layer to here, and then below this part will be dermal. So from here up is the epidermis, right? All right, so we're saying here, the deeper layer is the basal layer, and these cells, say every one of these blocks represents a cell, they are in a constant state of mitosis. Never stop. They are constantly turning over. Because at the very top, you're losing cells a mile a minute because they're exposed, and clothes rubbing and toweling off and all those sorts of things just comes off. So these cells here are in a constant state of mitosis, okay? to replace anything that that's getting lost. So the deeper layer is the basal layer, and cells found here are almost in constant mitosis. Newly created cells push the mature keratin cells up towards the surface. So as they're multiplying, as they're dividing, if this is the line of the dermis, they don't go this way, they go this way. So as they divide and mature, they're heading this direction, and then back here, they're still continuing to divide and mature. So everything is pushing apically all the time, all the way up. Anybody here have seborrhea or psoriasis? So any of those kind of conditions, those are a lack of balance of cellular division and sloughing off. So they get these big thick scabs of apical cells that aren't leaving, and they're building up behind, and this is when they get an inflammatory response because of it and so forth. So it's an imbalance of that homeostatic, losing cells, replacing cells. It's a little more complicated than that, but simply for now, and I'll be teaching you all that in September, trust me. So as the cells move superficially, they continue to make the keratin, which eventually fills the cell itself. And that by the time they get to the apical surface, they're dead and they're nothing more than keratin-filled plasma membranes. No more organelles, no more nothing. So down here, they have all the organelles and everything that they require to divide. And by the time they get to the top, just a cell membrane and keratin. Okay? And you've seen it. You know, when you've got dry skin and it fluffs off, or anybody's got dandruff, you know how white it is. And that's just because it's just a dead cell with nothing in it but keratin. Same idea. No, I think it's cradle cap's a fungus, isn't it? Where's the doula here? Yeah, it's a fungus, right? Yeah. Yes. Pretty sure I thought it was. So you can see here. Here we can see the dead cells at the top. Here we've got the dermis here in pink. Okay. Here we've got the most basilar layer of our keratinocytes dividing like mad and traveling superiorly. And you can see, remember we talked here about, we've got these laminar granules. You can see them up here, the little dots. So these are creating lipid. It's making it a little more waterproof. And as you can see, as we're heading upwards, by the time we get up here, see, there's no nucleus any longer. It's just a cell. And then now by here, it's completely replaced with keratin, just a membrane and a cell. And that's it. They're dead. And they're deliberately there to get sloughed off. Whereas down here, they're constantly dividing to replace. Okay? Everybody understand that so far? So we rub off millions of these cells every day to the point that you get a brand new full body epidermis every 35 to 45 days, completely replaced with new cells. Okay? In healthy skin, new cells produced equal cells lost. Friction areas, though, have greater mitosis to cell loss production. So anywhere where you have high friction, such as when you wear your sandals in the summertime, you know, your heel rubs on those straps, those sorts of things. If you're a farmer, you know, those first weeks out, and you're a construction worker, your hands, because of the friction of the shoveling and whatever, you get thickened skin as a reaction to protection to high friction. This is why I teased you guys things last week, right? Maybe the week before, how women go and they buy those stones to grind all the thick skin off their heel, thus applying more friction, which is going to promote more skin growth. Just accept your thick skin on your feet. It's okay. We don't mind. Now, I have had patients in the back, and maybe you know someone like this, or maybe some of you are this, where there was such excessive skin growth, you'd crack and get these half-inch deep craters right down into the dermis. You get them on your fingers. Yeah, I've had patients who literally it's almost like an earthquake where the skin just cracks open and I can see right down into the dermis. Yeah. Right. That's a condition that needs to be treated. I do know the one patient I had, and this was news to me, I was like, what? Where she went to an esthetician who had basically a razor blade. And slice thick layers right off, like peeling a potato, getting it all the way down. There was a cream that one of my patients promoted. What's it called? Genweiser? Many of the aesthetics, it's a German product. It's a cream. It's got their label as Grunweiser, Grunwiller. Anyways, she said it worked like a charm to some degree. So moisturizing does help it a little bit, but some people do have to do something about it because it gets so thick. But your basic sandals, whatever, just embrace it. This ability to be able to create or stimulate greater mitosis is partly controlled by something called epidermal growth factor. The next type of cell that we find here are the melanocytes. So the keratinocytes are all about keratinizing cells, creating this protective responsibility of our epithelial layer. Melanocytes are specialized cells which produce pigment, give our skin the color. So melanocytes produce melanin. Now, they are found in the deepest layer, in this basilar layer of the epidermis. They are spider-shaped, and they make contact with all the keratinocytes at the basilar layer. So your skin color is all created at the deeper layer of your skin. So the cell, all these cells, these melanocytes, again with these arms, they somewhat penetrate the membrane and release the pigments into those basilar cells. Okay? So they are spider-shaped. They make contact with all keratinocytes at that basal layer. And then melanin is produced in a membrane-lined granule called a melanosome, which gets created in the cell. Even people of color, when the keratinocytes get to the surface, they don't have the same pigment as the deeper color underneath. They will look somewhat white because, again, their cells are still dead, just like ours, with nothing more than keratin and cell membrane, so they tend to be a bit lighter. All color comes from the deeper parts. So we can see these extensions with these melanin granules. The pigment moves off the ends of the processes and is sloughed off, and then the keratinocytes munch on it, which then gives the color. The melanin accumulates on the sunny side of the nucleus of the keratinocyte to shield against UV rays. That is the newest belief. The other new theory is that we produce this material because it helps us maintain iron. So the understanding is that UV rays also break down iron, so we produce UV, we produce this melanin to prevent UV from having too much effect on it. Now, what happens, ladies, when your iron's low? Sorry? Okay, you can get anemia. And if you get pregnant, what happens if your iron's low? What can it cause? Okay, neural tube defects. So low iron equals spina bifida. Okay, neural tube defects. This is why they put you on ferritin when you're pregnant, to ensure that you don't get neural tube defects. So, yeah, same thing. Folic acid and iron, very, very similar. Okay, so this is why they are promoting for quite some time now, girls between the ages of 17 and 25 should never, ever go in a tanning booth. No, exactly. Fair enough. Okay? So this is one of the other reasons why they think it's there. All humans have the relative same amount of melanocytes. Isn't that crazy? It is likely the production of melanin that determines the color of skin. Yes? That you get lack of it. So you get lack of it. So, or if you have, what did Michael Jackson have? What did Michael Jackson have? The pigment changes. Alopecia. I'm pretty sure Michael Jackson had alopecia. Did he not? I thought he had pigment changes. Didn't Michael Jackson have alopecia? No, or is alopecia the hair loss, right? No, it's not alopecia. The one where you get the pigment changes. Vitiligo, I thought there was another one. Anyways. Did Michael have vitiligo? Okay. Yeah, okay. My grandmother had it. She would get dark spots, and the doctor back then would say, it's just your Portuguese coming out in you. No kidding, right? But here's my rant. A little tiny damn cell that gives skin a color, and all the bullshit that's gone around that, making suggestions that people with different color skins aren't as smart, aren't as capable, aren't this, aren't that, drives me absolutely mad. The only difference is a tiny little cell in the skin that makes us more yellow, more red, more black, more white. It's all it is. It means absolutely nothing to anything other than the color of skin. And if you think of it from an evolutionary response, if in fact melanocytes are there for high UV rays, why wouldn't people at the equator have darker skin to evolutionarily protect themselves against higher UV rays? And that's all it is. That's all it is. Drives me nuts. So you see here, you've got these extensions. They're down here, and they're connected to some degree to all these basilar cells, and they are providing the color that occurs to give us our various colors. Lack of. No melanocytes. No melanocytes. Anywhere. Like, that's not, it doesn't just affect their skin. Their eyes are a different color and everything. Yes, it's melanocytes. There's lots of reasons why people can be pink. I'm going to do a color thing here coming up. What's that? Well, we're going to learn that there are a number of different compounds that make us the color that we are. For example, beta carotene, right, is something that makes you more finding carrots. It makes carrots orange, right? So we have combinations of various pigments that give us the colors that we are in the wide variety that we have in the world. Even the old girls color their hair now, so you never know what their exact color is anymore, but because it's all our hair color and our skin color and our skin tones and so forth, is all nothing more than percentages of one pigment over another that kind of gives us. And we do have, to some degree, we do have influences, regions of the world, right? Northern Europeans, you know, Norwegian, Swedish, and so forth, very blonde, very white. Well, of course, there's no friggin' sun up there, right? Right? And as we work our way down, right, where we have high levels of UV, again, you start getting these differences of pigment distribution simply because they're influenced by whatever the environment is that they're in. The next are called Langerhans cells. They come from bone marrow. They are macrophages. So they form this network around keratinocytes. And it would make sense that if skin is actually a first defense of immunity to protect us, why wouldn't we have macrophages in the area in case something slips in and is trying to attack the body? We've got some macrophages there that can take care of it and have a little munch and get rid of them. The next are called Merkel cells. Now, these cells are right at the dermal-epidermal junction, and they're shaped like a hemisphere. They're kind of round. But what's important is they are intimately associated with a sensory nerve organ called a Merkel disc. And the Merkel disc is responsible for sending sensory messages back to the brain. You're going to take a whole lot more on these in your neural class. Just understand that we do have sensory organs that measure temperature, that measure vibration, that measure tickle, and measure pressure. And they don't all do the same thing. You have one for one for the next, one for the next, and one for the next. So your ability to feel all these different sensory things, whatever they may be, are all based upon a single sensory organ that's being stimulated to what it's sensitive to, such as temperature or whatever. They probably have a more sensitive tickle response. Their organ is more sensitive to it. Yes. So we can see here is here's the Merkel cell here, and you can see how closely it's set up with the tactile Merkel disc here. You can see them here. So here is your Langerhans here, your macrophage in here. Here's your melanocytes here, kind of extending out to all the basilar cells. Here's your Merkel disc and then your Merkel cell. So we're all kind of set up in this relationship between the epidermis and the dermis below. Okay? So when we look at it, you know, we've talked about, you know, all these layers of cells as we work basilar to apical. We have names for the layers. Of course we do. Just to confuse it further. In thick skin, there are 5 layers. In thin skin, there are 4. I repeat. In thick skin, there are 5. And in thin skin, there are 4. So we go from basale to corneum. And in thin skin, there is no lucidum, which is B. And we are going to discuss each of these. Okay? So basale, spinosum, granulosum, lucidum, and corneum. Stratum just means layer, or, you know, you get that even in with astrology. I think they talk about stratums. So think of it as a layer. So we have all these different names. With lucidum in your thick areas, such as your heel, and then no lucidum, you think of thin skin inside the inside of the thigh, that type of thing, right, where we have four layers. So you can see here in this diagram, the bottom of the screen is considered to be deep. And again, here we can see mitosing cells there, right? Here's your Langerhans cell, here your macrophage. Here's your Merkel cell here with your Merkel disc, right? We've got your melanocyte down here kind of talking to everybody. And we can see how these dots start going on here with these laminar granules producing lipids. And, of course, then to get to the top, we have these dead keratinocytes. So we're working from deep to superficial. So basale, basilar, your lowest. Spinosum there. Then granulosum, lucidum, and corneum. So we're going to sort of speak to all of them. Basale, of course, it is the deepest in the layer. It is firmly attached to the underlying dermis along a wavy border. So the other thing is, now why would we have a wavy border? What do wavy borders do? We talked about this before? Yes. So we've got the epidermis doing this. Okay. And then we have the dermis, like so. So what we've done is we have increased surface area of attachment, which makes a much stronger attachment between the epidermis and the dermis. Basically, the stratum basale is a single roll of mainly stem cells. So what we're talking about here are cells in the nucleus, right, all the way along and around that deeper layer, all the way throughout, okay? There are many mitotic nuclei here. It can be called stratum germinativum, tivum. I hate this word, that's why I don't use it, right? But basically, to germinate is to reproduce or grow. Okay, so within here, these are the ones that are dividing or have mitosis all the time. They're constantly dividing. 20 to 25% of this area are your melanocytes. So in here, we could draw, for example, we got blue. So again, we could draw this melanocyte here. That's, you know, going to reach out and give color to all the cells that are heading apically. Okay, so we find 20 to 25% are here. You do find occasional Merkel cells at this lower area as well, of course, because of that intimate association with the Merkel disc, which is found in the dermis, right, which is right there. Next is the stratum spinosum. So where basale was a single layer, spinosum is several layers. There's also bundles of intermediate filaments, remember protein, called tonofilaments. So they're there to help against any tension that's placed on the skin. I mean, you know, you can grab the skin on your hand and give it a pull, and you can place tension on it, and it can deal with it relatively well. They contain something called prekeratin, which, of course, further helps resist tension. The keratinocytes in here are flattened and irregular, but in here we find lots of Langerhans cells. Remember, Langerhans cells, immunity, macrophages, eat any invader that comes into the skin that may penetrate the skin and try to get in at the body, okay? So here's our stratum spinosum here. Quite a number of layers that we see here. You can see the tonal filaments here. I think you might have to get up close and personal with the slides or even on your own. You can see there's tiny little lines between the cells here that are kind of helping hold the cells together. And then, of course, we've got a Langerhans cell in here sort of stuck in the middle in this drawing. The next is, we didn't put granulosum in, I apologize. This should be granulosum, so you might want to write that on your slide set. So this is stratum granulosum. Found in the middle of the epidermis, there are 3 to 5 layers of flattened keratinocytes undergoing apoptosis. Do you remember what apoptosis was? Cell, yes, right? The cell is deliberately killing itself, right? It's dying off. In other words, you know, it's going to get rid of all its organelles, all those sorts of things, to eventually become completely filled with keratin, right? The nuclei and organelles of the cell are beginning to degenerate. The tonal filaments are becoming more apparent. And then we have another protein here called keratohyalin, which converts the tonal filaments into keratin. Everything's going to become keratin. So we had tonal filaments kind of hold together deeper, but now those tonal filaments are going to be converted to keratin as well, along with the keratin that we find in the cell, right? Becoming one large mass of protein, basically, is what it's going to become. When it is the keratinocytes in this layer that we find those laminar granules, which are membrane enclosed. Conclusions. That contain this lipid-rich secretion, which helps keep the skin moist and waterproof, all right? The secretion fills in the spaces between the stratum granulosum, stratum lucidum, and stratum corneum, acting as a water-repellent sealant. And you've all been led to believe by these companies that you're supposed to put hand cream on all the time because you lose this. You don't. It's down there deep. I mean, you can if you're, you know, it gets extremely dry and cracked if, you know, you're working outside in the cold, that kind of stuff. But generally speaking, you tend to maintain it, okay? Because the nuclei break down, they no longer have any physiological processes, and then they die. So they can't divide, they can't metabolize anything. Everything's dying off. They're just becoming a dead cell. This is the layer that makes the division between the active metabolic cells and dead cells. So it is the granulosum where we're going from cells that are somewhat alive or alive to eventually becoming dead, which is the most apical part, okay? Next is lucidum. It's a very thin, translucent band. We do find a few rows of flattened dead keratinocytes, no real distinct boundaries between the cells. And again, this is only present in thick skin, not in thin skin, okay? So we can see up here just this thin sort of whitish-gray area here underneath the next layer, which is the corneum, which is the outermost layer, 20 to 30 cells thick, but it does account about 3/4 of the thickness of your epidermis. So even though your epidermis may not be very thick, 3/4 of it is actually dead, right, by the stratum corneum. They are composed of a plasma membrane and keratin. This layer is all about protection, right, against abrasions, that kind of stuff. And there is also another glycolipid here, which helps make the skin waterproof. So, you know, that can come from pores, like oil pores that are, you know, secreting oil in the apical surface, keeping the skin soft. The cells protect the body from biological, chemical, and physical assaults. This layer of cells is dandruff, and this is what freaks people out. In your lifetime, you will shed 40 pounds of skin. So if that's the case, why aren't we all drowning in dead skin right now? If every one of us here in this world, the billions of people that are here, are shedding 40 pounds a year, imagine how much that builds up. And why don't we see any of it? What's that? Yeah. What's that? Yeah. What bugs eat it? Mites. So dust mites. Anybody here allergic to dust mites? Okay, you're not allergic to dust mites. You're allergic to dust mite poop. So dust mites eat dead cells. And you're allergic to their feces. Yeah, we got a lot. So, how many people here haven't changed their pillow in 20 years? Or 10? Or 5? You change your pillow regularly?
Yeah.
Like buy new ones?
Yeah.
Yeah? How many people still have their same pillow? Come on, be honest. Nobody? Oh, yeah, that's my point. So right now in your bed, your pillow is absolutely jack full of your cells, the skin cells, and dust mites, and so is your mattress. No, plastic they can't penetrate through. So if you have one of those, well, I can't imagine lying on a plastic pillow. Oh, that, no, I think it penetrates that stuff. Yeah, I know which one you mean. I think it do penetrate that. Eventually, yeah. Yep. So if you've got a pill that's even 5 years old, it is jacked full of mites, just having a, it's like a buffet, just having a grand old time. Yeah, exactly, right. Exactly. Yeah. Your towel, you know, people always argue and say, "Well, I don't have to wash my towel every week," right? Because I'm cleaning myself, I'm drying myself, and I'm clean. But what you're doing is, when you're using your towel, you are in fact actually rubbing millions of cells off into the towel. And by the end of the week, your bath towel, if you use it, you know, fairly often, is jack full of skin cells that you need to throw in the washing machine and wash the cells off. Nobody wants to say anything here. They're like, But 40 pounds, think about that. Because how much does a dead skin cell really weigh? So take that 40 pounds of mass into how much that would have to represent. That's garbage bags upon garbage bags upon garbage bags upon garbage bags of said skin. Yeah. Yeah, same as hair. I had to do that on the weekend. Get into the sink, get the lady's hair out of the sink. Especially when it's that long. Okay, so that's the epidermis. pretty straightforward. Of course, remember that, you know, it is the part that we affect the most. That's what we're touching when we're treating our patients, and touching skin is actually that epidermal layer. What time is it? Oh, we're doing good here. Okay. So let's go to the active part. So as much as there is activity in the dermal layer, but the, you know, the blood supply and so forth is in this deeper layer. It's in this dermal layer, not the epidermal layer. Basically, it's connective tissue. Okay, so that deeper layer is, it's the first slide, I think. Maybe it's the third. Is it the third? The dermis? The third one? Sorry, I mixed it all up, so it'll be the next slide. We'll just click them open and change them. Oh, me too. Trust me. Okay. So, so because it's connective tissue, and as you all listen to my connective tissue lectures, then what you find here is what's typical of all connective tissue. First is you have fibroblasts. What do fibroblasts do? Sorry? What does blast mean? Create, correct? So blast is a creator, a site is a maintainer, right? And a clast is an eater, okay? So a fibroblast, right off the bat, tells you it makes fibers, and it's one of the three, correct? Collagen, reticular, or elastic. Okay? So you have fibroblasts in here. You have macrophages, which are, again, line of defense, cell eaters. We have mast cells and white blood cells. They, too, are very active in the immune response. So if something does invade and get through the epidermal layer into the dermis, our first line of defense is all set and ready to go in case something happens. Now, with a deep wound that gets into the dermis, like a wound, like a knife cut or something like that, you can see how now we've damaged the integrity of the skin, and then this allows anything to kind of penetrate into the body. But again, we have these cells in here that can start the defense of anything that's trying to get in. So, the dermis is a semi-fluid matrix that is embedded with collagen, elastin, and reticular fibers. Why all three? Why do we need all three? You've got to think of what the responsibilities are. Go back to the lecture. Remember, what is collagen good for? What is reticulum good for? And what is elastin good for? Yes? Tension. Right. So imagine your skin, again, it's getting pulled and stretched in many directions all the time, correct? So we need them all in here. Elastic is important because, shall we say, we want things to snap back into place where they belong, right? Now remember, as we get older, one of the major things we lose is collagen. So our skin becomes less strong, has not got the ability to stretch, becomes very, very thin. Right? This is just a natural, normal reaction of age. We just stop producing collagen. And now, unfortunately, we've discovered how to inject it into our cells, and we do all kinds of weird and wonderful things with it. Right? Oh, which I don't find attractive at all. I don't know why, but whatever. Duck lips aren't exactly my thing, but that's okay. Right? So, in other words, we can say that the dermis binds to us like a stocking. It's like an overall body stocking that we carry. In other words, this is your hide. As I said, this is what we make leather out of with other animals. It is the dermis that we work with to create leather. That's what we use. It is richly supplied with nerve fibers, blood vessels, and lymphatics. So it's very, very active. Our hair follicles, our oil glands, and our sweat glands live in the dermis, not in the epidermis. They do penetrate the epidermis, hence the reason why we see hair and we see ducts heading out into the skin surface, right? But they do exist in the dermis, and then they have extensions that travel through the epidermis to the outside world. Okay, so we can see here we've got our epidermis, our dermis, and then our subcutaneous layer below. Within the dermis, of course, there's two layers. So we have five layers to the epidermis, and we have two layers to the dermis, okay? They are the papillary layer and the reticular layer. All right, so we can kind of see them here. So the papillary layer is the more superficial one. So we can see here we have these dermal papillae here. Whenever you hear the term papillae, it's defined as nipple-like. So you see sort of these long extensions that come up into the epidermal layer. And as we said, it helps promote surface area for attachment. So each of the rises that you see here in green are the papillae, which are part of the papillary layer in the drawing. So the papillary layer is a connective tissue in which the fibers form a loose woven map over that entire apical surface of the dermal layer. There are lots of blood vessels in here, and the superior surface is thrown into lipid-like projections called dermal papillae. And, of course, they're increasing surface area. In other words, they indent into the overlying epidermis. They come up into the overlying. It's like a reverse focaccia. Everybody ever make focaccias? Where you stick your thumbs in, you know, it's like think of it upside down, right? Many of these papillae contain capillary loops. So, of course, you've got oxygenated blood coming in. You've got deoxygenated blood leaving. Some others contain free nerve endings, so your pain receptors. So we do have special receptors that measure pain when we're looking at it. And there are touch receptors called Meissner corpuscles. So this is where they're all housed. So, you know, we do want, for obvious reasons, we do want sensory organs up in these papillae because, you know, they're going to be a much shorter route to determine whatever's going on outside and what we can feel as far as touch or tickle or pain or those sorts of things, right? On the palms and the soles of the feet, the papillae lie atop larger mounds called dermal ridges. So the papillae live on top of these dermal ridges. And these dermal ridges are what produce the looped and whorled ridges on the epidermal surface. Look at your fingers. You see a pattern, right, on your fingertips? We know these as fingerprints. Okay? So that's all that is these dermal ridges and the papillae on top. These ridges are there. They help increase our grip. They do provide an increased surface area, small as it seems, that does increase our ability to grip, right, when we're gripping. The patterns are genetically predetermined, so everybody's pattern is different, right? Due to sweat pores opening along the ridges of the crest, we are then able to leave fingerprints. So whether you think your fingers are dry or not, you still are producing oils that kind of reside on these ridges and you touch anything. You're going to leave that pattern of oil somewhere. And then if something goes on, the police are looking for fingerprints. They use a very, very, very fine dust that sticks to this oil. And then they kind of blow off the excess and you see the particular patterns that represent each individual's pattern of these ridges, which we call fingerprints. So you can see here, this is sort of a microscopic diagram here. So here's your papillary layer here with these extensions going up into the epidermis, we can see here, and then we can see when we peel it back, you can see how it looks a lot more like, you know, these nipple-like projections. It almost looks like, you know, that spongy foam, you know, that protective foam you can buy that's got all the little things sticking up, right? Kind of looks like that. And again, within those, think of blood vessels, sensory organs, and so on and so forth, okay? So that's the apical layer. Below that is what's called the reticular layer. And it accounts for about 80% of the thickness of the dermis. So the papillary layer is only about 20%. Below that is this reticular layer, and it's about 80%. And it is dense, irregular connective tissue. What does that tell you right off the bat? Dense, irregular connective tissue. Sorry? All directions. That's what's important to understand, is that when you have dense, irregular connective tissue, skin, that tissue can be stretched and pulled and twisted and sheared in many, many different directions and be strong in many, many different directions. That's the reason for it, okay? Its matrix contains thick bundles of collagen fibers that run into various planes, the majority running parallel to the surface. So you can see here in this microscopic cutaway, we do have some penetrating sweat glands here in this slice, but we can see that the red represents collagen, and you can see it's pointed in all different directions to be able to deal with the various vectors of stress or pull that can be placed on this tissue, and it will remain completely intact and not tear. Less dense regions between these bundles form lines of cleavage or tension lines. Less dense regions form these tension lines. And these run longitudinal in the skin of the heads and limbs and circular around the neck and trunk. It's not that important for us, but just have an understanding of it, that when we look of the head and limb, they're running this way. Okay, so head and limbs, right, running sort of lengthwise, these tension things. And then in the neck and trunk, they run in circles. This is kind of important for surgery. You'll see quite often, abdominally, how what's that surgery normally like? Tends to run this way. That way they're able to open up those fascial tension lines, get better healing. Now, occasionally they do need to go perpendicular to them for reasons, depending on the procedure, but that leads to more scar tissue and all those sorts of things. So this is why they attempt to cut accordingly, depending. So you saw both my scars on my shoulders are running this way, not this way, because of those tension lines, okay? The collagen gives strength and resiliency. And as we know, collagen binds to water. Did you understand proteoglycans in the lecture? Huh? I use the term a lot. Yes. Okay, so proteoglycans. Think of a toothbrush. Simple, everyday toothbrush. Proteoglycan kind of looks like that. Except that on every bristle of the brush is a water molecule. So it helps maintain hydration of connective tissue. One of the new theories is that pain patterns and dysfunction with connective tissue is because the connective tissue becomes dehydrated. Those bristles become empty. And when that happens, the connective tissues get stuck. So the reason you're going to learn connective tissue techniques next semester is to break those stuck layers apart and allow water into and rehydrate the connective tissue so that it slips and slides appropriately around it. So we say here, collagen binds water, which helps hydrate the skin. And it is the proteoglycans in there that do that. Proteoglycans are very, very important to connective tissue. As I said, hence the reason why we use these techniques to try to rehydrate connective tissue as much as we can. You all hydrate it, and it works together with you. So everybody here has made Jell-O. So Jell-O is a type of protein. Comes from little baby cow bones and veal bones. It does. Yeah, they boil the bones and get the collagen out of it, and then they make Jell-O with it. Tastes good to me. Yeah, that's right. So, collagen binds water, which helps hydrate the skin. Extreme stretching can tear the dermis, which results in what we call striae or stretch marks. So what's happened when you have stretch marks? The skin has been stretched to a point where the collagen is ripped apart, and it cannot go back together no matter what you use. All those creams and lotions. What's that? They do nothing. Well, they do, actually, and here's how they get you. Many of these creams are hydrators. So you put the cream on, and hydrates the tissue between the lines and looks normal. The next morning you wake up and they're back again because the effects of the cream have worn off and it's not hydrating anymore, and you go back to having the stretch marks again. Stretch marks are highly genetic, so if your mother has lots of stretch marks from her pregnancies and so forth, then you too will have them. It's just something that happens. Men get them as well for lots of reasons, and it can be pregnancy, obviously, a number one cause for females. Obesity, so people who've been very, very large and lose weight, right? They'll, because they've stretched their skin so much when they were quite large, and they lose, you know, these folks that lose 200 pounds or whatever, they're going to have striae and stretch marks, of course, because they, you know, they stretch their skin far beyond what it should have been. I'm not talking it's a bit overweight. I'm talking people who are quite large. But again, people who have a propensity for them doesn't take much. I've got them in certain areas of my body, and I don't know why they're there. I was never really overweight, but it just happens to be genetics as far as that goes. So extreme stretching can tear the dermis, which results in striae or stretch marks. A blister, a normal blister, is that defining part. So the top of the blister, where the fluid is the epidermis, and the pink underneath is the dermis. Okay? Because epidermis does not contain fluids. The dermis does, because you've got blood vessels in there and so forth. So the blister demarcates between the two. Flexure lines also reflect dermal modifications. We find these in the wrist, palms, soles, fingers, and toes. No, they don't tell the truth or your future. They're just flexure marks because you squeeze your hand all the time. Your lifeline is cracked. Okay? They occur at or near joints where the dermis is tightly secure. Now, the other thing is, and I don't really have this in the slides, you do have points where your skin sticks. It has to. Because if it didn't, honest to goodness, eventually over a lifetime, it would all be sagged down around your ankles, right? Because we're under the influence of gravity. So sternum, sacrum, elbows, knees, wrists. These are points where, because if you, next time you're in lab, roll them around and grab. Grab skin. See where it moves really, really well and see where it doesn't. If you guys, no, I won't do that. I need better backup or any shit for it. So we won't do it. But you're going to learn how to assess whether or not fascia or connective tissue is moving properly or not. So I want you to try this next time you're in when Michelle's not looking or Amanda's not looking. When you got your client on the table, this isn't anything outrageous. Just take your hands at the spine, push the skin away from the spine, pull the skin towards the spine on one side. Go around to the other side, push the skin away from the spine, push the skin towards the spine. See which one moves more than the other. They should be equal, but they won't be. And then you go up, down. And you'll see patterns where people have lots of movement in one direction or stuck in the other direction. It won't move. So you've got fascial restrictions, right? Fascial restrictions equal lack of range of motion, dysfunction in movement, and possible pain patterns. You're going to learn that, but it's just sort of the way to start off with. So we have to realize that, you know, we've got these tight areas. So the sacrum, for example, you're not going to get much movement there because there is a deliberate kind of stickiness of the skin on that sacral area to prevent the skin from moving so much. As I said, the sternum, like, you know, try to grab the skin on your sternum compared to your belly. That skin moves around a lot, but here not so much. It's deliberately stuck there to kind of hold us all together, okay? So we can see here stretch marks. I think I told you about my lady with connective tissue disorder, right? Is that? Okay, many years ago, I had a patient, and quite a lovely lady, quite young, actually. She was about 27. And very, not that it made a difference, but very, very attractive. I'm just trying to build a bit of a picture. Very, very attractive, smooth skin on her face. She worked with the police department as a operator, 911 operator, those sorts of things. And, of course, sitting all the time, she had back problems. So she comes in. We have her interview and do a bit of an assessment. Whatever, yeah, okay, we'll have a look. So I leave the room. Of course, she gets this rope. She gets on the table. She's going to start on her back first. So I take and I undrape her back. Her entire upper body looks like that on the left. Okay? She had a connective tissue disorder that her skin was not intact and firm. I literally, like a Sharpei, I could grab the skin of her back and pull it all the way up to here. It just sat on her body like a loose bag. For some reason, it didn't affect her face. I couldn't understand why she always wears high shirts, but it didn't affect her face in any way, shape, or form, or her hands, but her torso, her buttock area, her legs. The skin just literally hung on her just like nothing. It's like a whatever. And so she had a connective tissue disorder where the integrity of her skin couldn't be tight, and she was able to move. So this can also be associated with liver disease called ascites, and that can be part of that as well. But this is where we've had breakdown of that dermal layer and connective tissue is broken apart. This is kind of a more normal type we tend to see. And, of course, pregnancy, stretch marks around breast tissue or abdomen or buttocks is quite normal in females after a couple of children. Again, you get the stretching of the skin, and it just naturally tends to occur. So there's not a whole lot you can do about it. I mean, you've got a young lady here. Obviously, she's works out a little bit and tight skin everywhere. But, again, genetically, for whatever reason, there's breakdown of the connective tissue and there's stretch marks. That's just the way it goes. Yeah. You'll learn that in PASS. Because it's a mechanism by which connective tissue gets broken down because the liver is not functioning properly. They also get, ascites also can end up in extreme fluid. Oh, I've seen 20 liters taken out of a patient. 20 liters of fluid out of the belly because the liver's not working and it just accumulates. Big jugs they put in on the floor. Great big, what, they still use the glass ones or the big plastic ones? When I worked in the hospital, they were still glass. Just fill, just like pouring water out of a spout. Yeah, just that. Yeah. It's kind of stringy almost because a lot of protein in it. Yeah. There's a blister, and there's a blister. So you can see that when we've got the fluid in there, the white part represents the epidermis, and the pink underneath is the dermis. So when you have a bad blister, what you're seeing in the white is the epidermis, and what you're seeing in the pink is the dermis. Oh, I've had these from running and hiking, and so I'm sure many of us have had these. Once you get one of these, you're done no matter what they try. There's blister kits and all kinds of stuff you can put on, but it don't matter. So when I played basketball, I was a two-sock wearer with powder in between the socks. Worked like a charm. It's interstitial fluid that's leaked out of the dermis. Because the skin is no longer intact, and you have a separation here of the epidermis, osmotic changes, right, will result in the deeper fluids within the dermis will leak out into the space and take it over. The reason I show this picture, because the blister has broken, you get a nice look at just the dermis underneath. That's the dermis underneath, and this is all epidermis that's been loosened off the top. I'd love to do a nursing course because they have great pictures. Oh, wait till you see. Oh, I got some more pictures of this. Question I used to get asked all the time, and maybe people do or don't know this. When you get a tattoo, that needle penetrates into the dermis. The ink goes into the dermis, not the epidermis. That is why it's permanent. Now, I did date a lady many years ago who was trying to remove some tattoos that she had from a previous life, meaning not that she came back from somewhere, but that she, something that she was that she didn't like anymore. And she tried to remove tattoos, and I had no idea about removal of tattoos. And we got together for a date one afternoon after she'd been done, and she had on her leg, and she had this huge 4x4 bandage just soaked in blood. And I'm like, what the hell is that? She goes, that's my tattoo removal. Because they literally send a laser in that blows up the ink. Literally blows up the ink. So you get tissue damage and that. And even then, though, some colors could be removed, and other colors could only be diminished. So she would still have those colors no matter what. So always be aware when you get a tattoo, not against it, just make sure it's one you want to carry with you to the grave. You ever see those tattoos gone bad on Facebook and that? Some of the... There was a student in this course one time, and I saw a tattoo, and she was talking about it, and it was like John Travolta or something. It was one of her favorite, and I'm like, okay, color. We talked about this a bit. There are three pigments which are involved in our color. Melanin, of course, melanocytes, keratin, yeah. So, vasodilation. It's hyperemia, just like you do when you massage someone. But it's so global. We'll learn about this in cardiology. You don't have enough blood to go in every single blood vessel in your body if it goes wide open. You will go hypotensive and you will pass out and die. So you are constantly regulating how many blood vessels are open or closed at any given time to maintain proper blood pressure. When you get that flush, whether it could be for lots of reasons, they all open up and there's not enough blood to go around. You go hypotensive, and the first thing your body wants to say is, lie down, take a break, right? That's what happens. Okay, well, that's entirely different. So there's two things that can happen. One is you're going to have global vasodilation, which is redness. The second thing is, if for whatever reason, things like fight and flight with high anxiety states, so part of fight and flight is to take all the blood from outside and bring it all into the core so you can get the hell out of there, right? So what happens is you go gray. The same thing happens with a heart attack. When someone has heart problems, all the blood goes inside to help the heart, and this is why we use the term cardiac gray. I can look at somebody and in 10 seconds go, you need to call an ambulance. They're having a cardiac event. They go this color that's just it's greeny gray kind of, and you know that there's something's about to really happen. So, yeah, it's all about vasodilation and constriction. But that's the third type of color is hemoglobin. So hemoglobin is a pro is in your blood cells, red blood cells, and when it becomes oxygenated, that's what makes your blood red. Okay? So, anybody here seen anybody dead? Okay, what color are they? Kind of white. Everybody know what paraffin wax looks like? That whitish, that's what you would say. That's what I'd say. That, yeah, it's this opaquish kind of whatever. The reason your skin is the color it is because you have blood coursing through your dermis, and that, because your skin is somewhat opaque, that's what's potentially giving you a lot of your color, is because you have this flowing blood underneath. You stop that blood, it goes white, that whitey kind of paraffin wax color. So hemoglobin is one color. Keratin comes from fruits and vegetables, and then, of course, melanin comes from melanocytes. So melanin is made from an amino acid called tyrosine. It goes from yellow to reddish brown to black. Okay? Synthesis depends on an enzyme called tyrosinase, which is produced in the melanocyte. Remember, this passes from melanocytes to the basal keratinocytes, which will eventually, make up go to the apical layer of the epidermis. Racial differences is a result of both the kind and the amount of pigment. Freckles and pigmented moles are nothing more than accumulation of melanin. So we just get this accumulation of it. It aggregates together and gives us, these various spots on our body that give us various colors as far as that goes with it. Yeah. They literally burn them. They use light to kind of bleach them. Yeah, it's not as good. It's not as good. But again, some of that is ethnic in nature and cultural in nature, right? Trying to become a whiter color in some cases and removing darkness and so forth. Again, constructs that we stupid freaking human beings make all the time. Yes. No, not cutting them. But they can. So always remember this. Whenever you have a tissue that has a high turnover rate, is constantly dividing, the potential for mutated cells goes up. And then you have the intervention of UV rays, which really is radiation, no different than an atomic bomb, that's penetrating the DNA. Everybody here has heard of free radicals, right? So they're smashing the hell out of nuclei and screwing up the DNA. So you all, every one of you, every single person in this room has the potential for cancer. The question is, because you're producing mutated cells all the time, what we're trying to figure out is, why does 99% of the time the body goes, you don't belong here, and kills you because you're mutated and you don't belong here, and yet you sneak in and boom, 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 you start dividing and all of a sudden you're a tumor. Why does that happen? We're still trying to figure out all the exact mechanisms. So, because I think the future of curing cancer, well, we're never going to cure cancer, but our future of, what's that? Well, it's fighting it. It's the diversity of cancer. We will never cure cancer. So this whole idea of the Cancer Society, we're going to cure cancer, is a pile of BS. We will never stop mutated cells. We have to figure out how to get the body to see mutated cells and deal with them. So the future, I think, of cancer care is going to be how we turn on our immune system to have our body kill it for us. Potential. Correct.
Right?
Correct. Yeah. BA, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you have a higher percentage,
I think your potential would still be so high. Yeah. It's a genetic setup that you've won the lottery the wrong way. And that's why, you know, someone like Angelina Jolie just said, cut them both off. I'm not even going to take the chance. Just get rid of them. They're only breasts. And I'll deal with it the rest of my life as far as that goes. So
she had the genetic marker.
She did. That's correct. Yeah, that's why she had her bilateral mastectomy, because they discovered the markers. And even then, even markers aren't a guarantee you will, but it's up to the individual. This is why there's a big ethical conversation around, you know, these biomarkers and those sorts of things, or genetic testing, you know, with the 23andMe stuff. Well, eventually they're going to say, oh, there's Parkinsonism in your family. So what are you going to do about that? Are you going to say, cut it out, get rid of it, whatever it may be, I'm not going to have children, all those sorts of things, because all it is potential, because there are other things that do influence. But ultimately, when we look at it, you know, this idea when we talk about skin, because we're going to talk about skin cancer in the fall, is, you know, because we have high turnover rates in skin, potential is always there under the influence of other things for skin cancer to occur. I got 3 growths that are coming off hopefully in the next few weeks. It's called actinic keratosis, and this is precancerous. Because I'm an idiot and I play golf all my life and never wore sunscreen. Duh. And fish. Okay, so melanin's that color. Keratin is yellow to orange, found in certain plant products such as carrots. It's vitamin A. Anybody here have to take the vitamin A thing for acne as a kid? Ladies, you have to sign on we won't get pregnant sort of thing. I can't remember the name of the drug. Yeah, it's an ant. Sorry, Accutane. Accutane, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And you had to sign that you wouldn't get pregnant because it can cause terrible birth defects. But it's vitamin A, basically. Keratin tends to accumulate in the stratum corneum and the fatty tissue of the hypodermis. It's most obvious in the palms and soles because of the thickening of the corneum there. It can also accumulate when large amounts are ingested. So if you eat enough carrots, you can actually turn orange. Hemoglobin, as I said, it's part of the red blood cell within the blood itself. It contributes to the pinkish hue. It's a result of red hemoglobin in the RBC as it circulates through the dermal capillaries. Obviously, more noted in Caucasian peoples than those of African American descent or darker color. In a low oxygen environment, the skin can appear blue because of less lack of oxygen, and we call that cyanosis. Remember, cyan means blue. In darker-skinned people, the way we have to look for it is either in the mucous membranes of the cheek, or we pull the eye down to look inside the lid to see whether or not it's nice and whitish pink in there, or something other than. So, when we look at disease and color, sort of an introduction to real quick, is anything going on? Of course, redness or erythema can indicate embarrassment, fever, hypertension, inflammation, or an allergy. Also, a condition called hemochromatosis. People who have too many red blood cells. We've got a friend who has to go to the hospital every month and give away 2 liters of blood to nothing because he overproduces red blood cells. So that is it. Yeah. No, I don't think they can because of his disease. I'd have to double check it. It's a good question. I'm not sure if they use it or not. But he has to go all the time. Anemia and those sorts of things. Yeah, absolutely. Pallor or blanching, so emotional stress, anemia, or low blood pressure. How many people here think they have anemia? Anybody here got a gold ring? You know this? Anybody here have a gold ring? Wedding ring? Nobody here has yellow gold? Okay, I'll show you something that works every time. See, I'll ask and see, because I show you, I can tell whether or not you're anemic. It's the simplest test in the world. Use yellow gold. You know what I'm talking about? If someone's anemic and you take a gold ring, it's got to be gold, put it down their face, you'll get a black line. Yeah, it changes the acidity of the oils in the body. And if someone's anemic, I just take a gold ring and slide it up and down, they'll get a black line. Yes. Yeah. And I learned that from a pediatrician, not from a naturopath or anything. It's a real easy test. It's not perfect, but if they saw it, and I've sent students to the doctor, and they said, oh my God, it is black. You should probably go get a blood tests and see how bad it is or it isn't. Now, obviously, in females, I mean, there are periods of time where you're more likely to be anemic than others, of course, because of your cycle, right? So that's something that women deal with all the time because of the blood loss once a month, so it does occur. She's got a ring. You don't have a gold ring on you, do you? Okay. Jaundice, yellow liver or biliary disorders. So what happens is you have excess bile pigments in the blood because the liver isn't working properly. So quite often with people with liver disease, could be from alcoholism, those sorts of things. Bronzing is a particular to a disease called Addison's disease, which is hypofunction of the adrenal cortex, and the gums look bronze. They're a bronzy color. The last one is black and blue marks, of course, bruising. So it's escaped blood from circulation with clotting, with a hematoma. You can also have deficiency of vitamin C, or hemophilia can result in this. So here we can see red skin. Now the lady on the left has something called contact dermatitis. So what's happened is this individual has maybe used a new beauty cream or makeup removing cream, and you can see the pattern right, down the neck when you're spreading it, right? And then, boom, she has a reaction to it, an inflammatory reaction. So ultimately, that's inflammation. The lady on the bottom right has a condition called acne rosacea, which you may or may not heard of. Again, an inflammatory kind of condition that can really lead to redness. Blanched skin, of course, some people do blanch their skin, especially if they're gothy. They like to look white for whatever reason. But this is what I'm talking about with those of darker skin, is you must get into the tissues around the eye. It helps you much better to see whether or not there's appropriate oxygenation of blood, those sorts of things, because of the color. Okay, jaundice, that is not a colorized picture. That is someone in end-stage liver disease. And they can get that color. Note the eyes are purely yellow as well. Yes, right. Yeah, it's that's classic end-stage liver disease right there. Bronzing, you can see the bronzing around the gums there in the teeth. That's Addison's disease, that's hypoadrenalism. And a bruising. What do you think is wrong with this individual here? What happened there? Sorry? No, they're elderly. That's your clue.
It looks like when you turn 40, your leg down the bedroom.
No, it's not. Any other suggestions? It is a hematoma. It's quite large. What's the reason for it being that large? No. Well, you're not wrong in that, but that's not what I'm thinking. Blood thinners. This is an individual who's had a normal bruise in a long-term care facility who had an impact, just what you and I'd get, maybe get, a bruise about the size of a loony or a toony. But because they're on a blood thinner, all that blood runs into that fascial compartment and just goes everywhere because they don't stop bleeding. That's basically what that is. Oh, absolutely, yeah. No, but they would just... I think I told you guys the story when I was taking blood in the hospital with a lady for an INR. So I used to do phlebotomy in the hospital way back when as part of my cardio thing. So I go into this elderly lady, I got to do her INR, which is for warfarin, which is an old-time blood thinner. And you have to measure these counts to make sure that they're not, shall we say, less or more able to clot, okay? So I do all the things I have to do and find out it's her, pull my tubes out, my tourniquet and so forth. And I put the tourniquet on, I put the needle in, I take my two or three tubes, undo the tourniquet, put the gauze on, ask her to hold on to it, turn to my machine, putting in, my stickers on my tubes and day and time, yada, yada, yada. I turn around and it's like she took her arm and put it in a can of red paint from her elbow to her fingers, just covered in blood and just pouring off her fingertips. INR wasn't good. Just blood everywhere. I was like, okay, take a break. See you guys about 10 after. Yay, we're going to get skin done tonight. Hey, let's continue this. We have one set of slides left when we're done the skin. So we talked about the layers of the skin, the epidermal layer and the dermal layer, colors can affect or show us pathologies. But there are other structures that do belong to the integumentary system, but aren't skin. So hair is the first one. Of course, as compared to other mammals, our hair is not as protective or insulative, but we do still retain hair on our bodies. It does protect the head from the sun, and of course, it helps prevent heat loss from the scalp. Our eyebrows and eyelashes protect the eyes from foreign particles, so they help us maintain things from getting out. And ours is more of a sense organ. So because we have a hair root plexus, a sensory nerve that attaches to the root of the hair, this is why, I could put you all in a dark room and just make something go quickly past that would cause a bit of a breeze to make your hair move. You would suddenly know that there was something there because you would feel that hair move. Adulthood, each gender has a specific hair pattern. This is likely that testosterone has a greater effect on hair growth. I have had females who are relatively hairy. I've had males that are relatively unhairy or hairy, and get every combination thereof. That is one of the challenges for massage therapy is massaging an area where there is an extremely large amount of hair and it all getting stuck in your hands and fingers with the grease. I used a product called Biotone Cream. It is the consistency of toothpaste, and that's what I used my entire career. You don't need much of it, and it goes through hair like it's not even there. It's expensive, but I really liked it. Biotone Dual Action is what it's called. Great stuff. But I don't like slippery. So this is a stickier lotion because I did a lot of fascial work. So I didn't want, I don't like using, I hate oils. I hate massaging with oils. But this stuff I really came to like. And again, you didn't have to use huge amounts of it and it worked great. But as I said, it is a bit expensive, but you might want to try it. So there are a few areas of the body where we don't find hair: palms of the hands, soles of the feet, lips, nipples, and some areas of the external genitalia. We don't find hair at all. Months before birth, we have these hair follicles that start to form within the dermal layer and in most parts of the skin. My youngest brother, he was actually born, what's it called? Lanego? When they're really hairy, when a baby's really hairy, is it Lanego? Am I saying it right? No, it's close, right? Yeah. He was completely covered in hair. They called him the fifth beetle at the time. He was born in 62. He had a full head of hair all the way down to his shoulders, and his entire body was covered in hair, and within a week it was all gone. It all fell out. Oh, you can imagine the teasing he got as a kid. Hairs can also be called pili. Basically, it's a flexible strand produced by the follicle. So hair is a flexible strand, and guess what? It's made up of keratinized cells. Okay? It's made up of keratinized cells, but the keratin is a bit different as to that found in the skin. Still keratin, but a couple of different properties. Hair is dominated by hard keratin, while skin is dominated by soft keratin. And this hard keratin is tougher and more durable, and the cells tend not to flake like they do in the apical layer in the epidermis. Lanego, that's it. I knew it was close. So the part that you see outside the body, this is known as the shaft. So the hair that you see outside the body is the shaft. And of course, it projects outside the skin, outside the apical surface to be seen. The hair root, though, is the portion of the hair that's deep to the shaft within the follicle. So the root's down deep in the follicle. The shaft is what you're seeing here. So there is the shaft, again, the part that you can see, and then the root sits down deeply in. Okay? The root is embedded in the skin. It does penetrate the dermis and sometimes the subcutaneous layer. Not unlike the shaft, there are three layers to it. There is the medulla, the cortex, and the cuticle. So we can see here we've got the medulla in the center, the cortex out of that, and then the cuticle on the outside. So even within the follicle, we have these three layers, but your hair outside your body still has all three layers. Okay? Medulla, cortex, and cuticle. Makes up all of your hair. You have these three layers. The medulla, this is the portion that can be lacking in thinner hair. So if hair's thinning, the medulla may be missing. And basically, it's two or three rows of irregular shaped cells. We can see here, kind of coming up the matrix here, the medulla is this yellow part, kind of see a bit of it here, and you can see it coming out here into the hair root itself, as it's going to continue out into the hair that's exposed into the body or the shaft as it leaves. The cortex forms the major part of the shaft, and it is made up of elongated cells. So here's the small medulla here in the center. We have these cells that run the entire shaft, running parallel to the length in a longitudinal fashion. So they're all cells running along the shaft and from the hair follicle. The cuticle is the outermost layer. It is a single thin layer of flat cells that are heavily keratinized, and they're arranged like shingles on a roof with the edges facing upwards towards the tip. That may seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? So instead of sitting like this towards the scalp, they sit like this towards the tip. Okay? They're arranged like shingles on a roof facing upwards. The thought is that this configuration helps keep the neighboring hairs away so you don't get all this matting. So your hair is able to stay relatively singular on its own. The cuticle does provide strength and keeps the layers tightly compacted. When the cuticle breaks down and breaks apart, you know this as frizz. Okay, so quite often, you know, I haven't seen it much on advertisements anymore. Do they promote certain shampoos to prevent frizzing? You get that frizzy hair, whatever. Because some women do get haircuts, right? Because the ends finally get long enough that they start to break down, and it looks like that. Under the electron microscope, so you see you've got the cuticle basically breaks apart, and the two inner layers start to come out from underneath as the cuticle frizzes out and breaks down. You can see here, again, this is 70 tines. You can see how the cells face shingle and face upwards towards the shaft. This is a lovely picture that shows you the keratinized dead cells of the epidermis as they sit. Looks smooth to the naked eye, but under the microscope, it's actually quite rough like that. Those are all your keratinized dead cells on that most apical layer of your epidermis. Now, color, of course, no different than our skin. We have pigments that do impregnate into the hair that gives us the variation of colors that we see out there. So it's created by melanocytes at the base of the hair follicle and transferred to the cortical cells. So melanocytes at the base to the cortical cells. Obviously, we get variations of all the colors, you know, yellow, rust, brown, and black that produce all the various colors of the hair. Gray or white hair results from decreased melanocyte production, and where that melanocyte should be is actually an air bubble. So what you're seeing in my hair, because my hair is so gray, I have no melanin in my hair. I have air bubbles, and what you are seeing as white is the refraction of light as it travels through my transparent hair shafts, and just the way the light acts to it.
How come when you're younger, your hair changes, like was like very blonde?
Just genetic influence, possibly. Both my daughters were platinum blonde until they were about 12, and then now they're dark. Well, now I have no idea what their real natural hair is, because they're purple and then they're pink and then they're all sorts of things. So, it just has to do with just the maturation of genetic influence that eventually other things can do it. I've had women say their hair changed desperately. I really changed after they got pregnant. Stress, some individuals get hair color change in high stress situations, that kind of stuff. Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I would assume that it maybe colors just the cuticle. I don't know. I usually have an esthetician to take the program who give me hell about lots of things. That's not the way it works. But maybe it's just the cuticle. I don't know what gets colored. Is it? Okay. I mean, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but way back in the day, hair coloring used to be just a terrible thing for women's hair. Like back in the 30s and 40s, it was these harsh chemicals that would do things. But yeah, now you just, that looks cool. Last few days and move on to the next color, right? Now, the shaft, as I said, is the superficial portion of the hair that projects out of the skin and is exposed to the outside world. Remember that it is a continuation of the root's three layers, medulla in the center, then the cortex, then the cuticle. So no different, right? Still the three layers, even though it's left the body. The hair follicle is down deeper. So we have the shaft, which is the part that sticks out of the hair that we see. Then we have the root, which is this part here, sort of in the middle.
And then we have the hair follicle, which is all the way down in here, down the lower parts. So it extends from the epidermal surface into the dermis. So the follicle actually goes down and penetrates into the dermis. So if I were to just do something like this, we would see something like that, that the follicle would dip down into to the dermis. The hair follicle surrounds the root, and at the deep end, it expands to form what is called the hair bulb, which is its most proximal, deepest portion. So we have the shaft, we have the follicle, and then we have the hair bulb that's down here, which is the deepest part that we can see right here. So within this bulb, we have a root of sensory nerve endings called a root hair plexus that surrounds the bulb. And it is this root hair plexus that lets us know when our hair is being touched and moved, and we can feel it. It does give us sensory feedback. This hair root plexus wraps around each hair bulb, and bending the hair stimulates the plexus that something's touching. Okay? It is the plexus and the ability to sense movement that makes hair a sensory organ. Now, when the follicle sits in to this area, it is held in by some layers. So there are two layers that surround the follicle. The first is an internal root sheath, which is formed by the dermis. So the dermis comes down and fills it in. Then there is an external root sheath that sits outside the internal root sheath, and this is formed by the epidermis. So the epidermis comes all the way down into the very bottom where the hair bulb is. And then medial, or inside to that, is the internal root sheath. So internal is formed by the dermis, and the external is formed by the epidermis. We say it invaginates, which means it comes down and deep in, so it's coming down into the area. Together, both the internal and the external root sheaths form the epithelial root sheath, holding that the follicle sits in. All right? So you can kind of see it. Oh, come on, you. Come on. Where are you? Oh, maybe I have it in the next slide. I thought I had it here, but maybe not. But you can see how it kind of comes in and sort of surrounds it. You can see it here. So, you know, you've got... here is the dermal root sheath here. So there's the internal root sheath here coming in, which is the dermis. Then we have the external root sheath coming in here, coming all the way down and filling in, kind of surrounding the hair itself. Okay. There is a dense dermis that surrounds the whole follicle, and this is just called the dermal root sheath that we see here. At its most inferior surface, we find a nipple-shaped indentation called the papillae, which we see right here. The papillae contains a knot of capillaries, which supplies nourishment to the hair. So we have a very small capillary bed here. How many people here, when you pull a hair out when you're trying to trim your eyebrows or whatever, you get a little drop of blood? Anybody ever had that? You pull a hair out and just get just a very, very tiny drop of blood. You could be doing damage to that blood vessel in that papilla. You've just broken it a bit and you're getting a little bit of blood that comes out where the hair was. It's not unusual. Within the bulb is an active portion of hair growth called the matrix. So not unlike what we saw with the epithelial layer, where we had this mitotically active layer of division that was heading to the apical surface, we get the same thing here. The matrix contains cells that are dividing and filling up the space. Of course, hence the reason why our hair grows longer. So we get mitotic activity here at the matrix layer, and then as, of course, it's heading out, the cell becomes more keratinized, and it, by the time, you know, it's out to the shaft, it's dead, right? You don't feel you're getting your hair cut, right? There's nothing left there. It's just dead cells. So the matrix is composed of stem cells, and it is these stem cells researchers are looking at to maybe differentiate into other structures to help people. Matrix cells are responsible for the growth of existing hairs and for the growth of new hair. And, of course, the replacement process occurs in the same follicle. So the follicle is always replacing cells that are dying and leaving out into the shaft. So we always have this constant growth, okay? So, again, we see the matrix. It's more... right here, and we have this cell growth there. And, of course, we'd have melanocytes here, which are coloring the hair the same as it would the skin, only it's coloring the hair, not skin cells. We also have an associated muscle to our hair. This is known as erector pili. It's associated with hair follicles, and they approach the skin surface at a slightly oblique angle. So you can see erector pili right here coming down towards the follicle and up here on an oblique angle up into the epidermis. It's attached this way that the contraction pulls the hair into an upright position, which produces goosebumps. Why would we want to pull our hair upright? Not quite. What happens when a dog gets really freaked out? Hackles, right? This is the leftover for us. It's our hackles. So in fear, we stick out all our hair to make ourselves look bigger. Doesn't do much good, does it? That's why the dog gets hackles. They're trying to make themselves look larger, so their threat is a little more afraid of them as far as that goes. That's what I say, right? If you're into a bear, get big. Yeah, black bears. Although I've been chased by a black bear. It wasn't fun. I didn't know I could run that fast without my feet touching the ground. But also, when it does contract, that's when you get the goosebumps as well, right? And, of course, the goosebumps are causing the erector pili to contract. Contraction has a side effect of heat, which allows us, hopefully, right? Goosebumps are a representation of the muscles trying to contract along with the shaking to create heat to warm ourselves up. Glands. So we talked a little bit about glands. We were talking about the epithelial layer, but we have to talk to them because they do have a rather large association to the hair itself. So the first are sebaceous glands or oil glands, right? They're connected to the hair directly to the hair follicle, and they lie in the dermis and open into the follicle. In the lips, glans penis, labia minora, and glands of the eyelids, these areas have the glands secrete directly onto the surface of the skin. The idea being that it keeps it moisturized, keeps it healthy, because these areas of the body do require moisture on a regular basis. We don't want these tissues drying out. So this is maintained via these sebaceous glands, these oil glands, leaking out directly onto the surface of this area onto the skin itself. So here's our sebaceous gland here, and it uses the movement of the hair to drive the oil to come up onto the apical surface here and help maintain moisture. Sebaceous glands produce something called sebum, which is a mixture of triglycerides, cholesterol, proteins, and salts. It also coats the hair and prevents them from drying out. Also prevents excessive evaporation of water from skin, and in some cases, the chemicals in it, it does diminish the growth of bacteria. This is why, are you really supposed to wash your hair every day? No, because your body already produces substances which helps keep your hair healthy, okay? Sudoriferous glands, also known as sweat glands, you have over 3 to 4 million of them on your body, and they release sweat onto the hair follicles, which then, of course, goes directly onto the skin. There are two types of sudoriferous glands, eccrine and apocrine. So let's do the eccrine first. Most common of the two, eccrine is the most common sudoriferous gland in the body, found everywhere but margins of the lips, nail beds, fingers and toes, glans penis, glans clitoris, labia minora, or eardrums. You will not find this type of gland in those areas. You produce approximately 600 millimeters per day of sweat. Okay, we're always producing it. It's kind of important. It's mostly water with sodium, chloride, urea, uric acid, ammonia, amino acids, glucose, and lactic acid. Have you ever smelled someone who's got sweat that smells just like urine? Yes, it smells very similar. It's because of the urea. So it usually can be a condition where they're not producing urea. They're not getting rid of enough urea through the kidneys, so they're starting to try to release it through it. You see it quite a lot with diabetics, for example. You'll find sweat that really smells like urine just because of the urea. Controls body temperature, of course, through evaporation. And this whole idea of sweating and getting rid of waste through sweat, it's so small. Sweat does get rid of some things, but not so much. So we can see here's our eccrine sweat gland right here, releasing sweat right onto the surface through a pore onto the apical surface of the skin. apocrine glands, they have larger ducts, so much larger in diameter, and the lumen is large as compared to eccrine. We find these glands in the axilla, groin, areolae, and bearded regions of the face of males, and quite often under the microscope, their secretions look milkish or yellowish. And they have a bit. Have you ever noticed how you, you know, if you have a bit of a large production in the axillary region, how if you're wearing something white, it will have a stain to it? That's because there is a bit of color to what's secreted with these glands, hence the reason why. It's the same components as eccrine with lipids and proteins. It is odorless. So, what causes body odor? It's the bacteria eating your sweat and their feces. That's what gives you the body odor. Yes? Just a chemical, one of those chemicals within it, you're over-secreting and it's causing a chemical reaction to it. My oldest, when she was a teenager, had hypohidrosis. And she had to go on a special deodorant because she would just sweat unbelievable amounts of sweat. And there was no smell to it. She just got tired of always being soaking wet all the time. So I never did like it because it actually is a chemical that squeezes all the pores shut. I don't see that as being healthy, but young lady sweating all the time, she didn't feel comfortable with it. I have never used an antiperspirant in my life. Yes, you can. I believe you can. Yeah, I can't imagine. Oh, my God. Sticking needles up in your armpits. Jeez. But yeah, it's. I don't believe in any perspirants. You're supposed to sweat. It's all deodorants or talcum powder, those sorts of things. Now, some people do have an excessive amount of bacterium in certain areas of the body, and they do have body odor, and they have to deal with it. And it doesn't mean that. Now, always remember this when you're treating people, too. You may get individuals on your table who do have extreme body odor. It does not mean they're dirty. Now, you always have to keep that in mind. Some people do struggle. We did have a student in this program many years ago, and he had a condition. I don't remember what it was, but when he got stressed out, the odor that would come off of him would make you gag. And it was just chemical reactions, and his sweat is a reaction to stress, those sorts of things. So you get lots of combinations out there. These glands also don't function until puberty. So they are, believe it or not, considered to be sexual attractants. No, or just even the odor itself. We have been led for so many generations, we do everything to remove normal body smells to be replaced with perfumes and colognes and so on and so forth. And in fact, as human beings, we were actually attracted to each other via our particular odors. No different than a dog or cat. What's the first thing a dog does when it meets a new dog? Right? Yeah, in places that we wouldn't like, hi, how are you, right? Yeah, exactly. But that's how they work because they're all sense oriented, right? We are to some degree as well. We have to remember that. Okay, so you can see that the eccrine directly into the skin, apocrine directly into the follicle, which then goes into the skin. Ceruminous glands, these are modified sweat glands that we find in the external layer. Of course, these are the glands that produce wax, this is what we consider wax in the air. And that waxy material is called cerumen. And its whole purpose is to provide a sticky substance that prevents things from going into the ear, including insects. Because there are some areas of the world there are insects that will take advantage of an ear hole to get into where it needs to go. And they're not earwigs that do it. Okay? And of course, one thing we never do is stick Q-tips in your ears. It's only this long, not Q-tip long. Right? You don't want to rupture an eardrum. So you can see here, you've got outer ones, sir, cartilages, hair follicles, sebaceous and ceruminous glands are out here. And then the medial two-thirds, thin skin overlying the osseous canal, that can easily be traumatized by something like a Q-tip. Okay? If you do have a wax problem, go to your doctor and get it flushed, if that's what you need, because this is what you're supposed to clean your ears with, is your little finger. Candles! Ear candling is a pile, capital B, capital S. So much so, the CMTO has outlawed them. We are not allowed to use them. They don't work. And have you ever had ear candling? Okay, picture this. Okay, you lie on your side. I put a little tray over your ear with a hole in the bottom. And then I take a tube of cotton that's been dipped in paraffin wax. So it's hollow in the center and narrows down to a very fine tip. I put the tip, the plates here to cover your ear. I put the tip in the hole so it's in your ear hole. And I light this on fire. So there's flames going. And the idea is that the flame is creating a vacuum that will suck things out of your ear. Essentially, what was happening was, as the cotton was burning, ash and whatever was falling down into the eardrum. And it did nothing. Because we had this person come in our class. She did it. And there was all this fluffy stuff in the bottom of it, like copious amount of it. So one of my study buddies from university said, okay, we have to do scientific method. So you've done it in the air. Let's just burn one and pretend. So she said, sure. So she burned it down. Same amount of fluff in it. There is no conceivable way when you look at it in the air that you have a quarter cup of something in your air. And the Egyptians did it. The Egyptians believed that cleaning wounds with cow dung would clean your wound. So why do we go back that far? Anyways, together. Yeah, so you can't do them anyways. As a massage therapist, you cannot do your kindling. You'll never get it. It doesn't work worth a damn. You're better off to have your husband or partner stick their lips in and suck. What's that? Yeah, exactly, I know. Nails. Plates of tightly packed, hard, dead, keratinized epidermal cells. So you get the idea, right? The reason why these accessory things belong to the integumentary system because they all use keratin in some form or other to work. Obviously, these are hard. So it forms a clear, solid covering over the dorsal surfaces of the distal portion of the digits. There's a nail body, a free edge, and a nail root. That kind of makes sense, right? Nail root, of course, is where the nail grows out of. The body is the main part, and the free edge is what you clip, right? The nail body is the visible part. The free edge is what we clip and is white because there's no capillaries underneath. And, of course, the nail root is found deep underneath that we see here. So with the matrix, same idea. We have cells that divide, get keratinized, fill in the spots, and then the nail grows as it continues through. The crescent-shaped area of the proximal end of the nail is called the lanula. So it looks moon-like, right? Like a half moon, like a crescent moon. Crescent to a half moon. It's white because it's thick. Average growth of nails is 1 millimeter per week, but slower in toenails because they tend to be thicker and larger. Okay? They protect, provide support to the finger, and in certain types of grasps, and allow us to scratch and groom, like any other primate does. Right? We're always picking at ourselves. I watch you guys. Everybody's always picking and scratching and doing whatever. Right? We all do. It's all part of our normal whatever, right? So we can see here, here's the lanula here and the white part. And the only reason is because the nail is extra thick there and you can't see through it, so you're seeing the white. The color that you're seeing here, of course, are the capillary beds underneath and the dermal layer. Nails are a very good source of determining health because it is a bit of a window into the underlying tissue. If someone's cyanosis, in other words, their blood is low in oxygen, these will be as blue can be, okay? You can see here from a health perspective, on the top here, these are called clubbed fingers. They are associated to lung disease, COPD, emphysema, not directly, but it can possibly express there's some lung disease here, and I can't remember what this is. Is this Addison's? But it's, again, a metabolic disorder that the nails actually peel in the opposite direction and curl up. Then comes the big one. This is called nail fungus. You're seeing the advertisements for it on TV all the time now. Right? This, again, goes back to long-term care. These are highly, highly contagious. And we can't cure it yet. We can work with it, but we can't cure it. If you go into long-term care and you see this, make sure you are wearing gloves if you're working on their feet because it's very contagious, and once you get it, you pretty much have it for life. This is very advanced stages, but that's basically a fungus that's destroying the nail, and that's what you get. I'm sure you saw it a lot. Orals and... Easily. And even then, it's not even a guarantee. So they get it on the shower rooms and that kind of stuff because they're sharing shower rooms and so forth. Think of it kind of similar to athlete's foot, right? It's a fungus as well, so hence the reason why you always have to be careful in public shower stalls Now, interesting enough, I've never wore a pair of shower sandals in my life, and I've never, ever had athlete's foot. Yes, you could. Yes. Yeah, call them, I used to call them shower sandals or shower shoes. Never worn them in my life. They didn't exist when I was a kid. When I was a young guy playing like lots of sports and that, you know, remember back in the day in high school? No. And in high school, like the boys' shower room was one big room with shower heads. We didn't have separate stalls or anything, right? So we just all walk around and never wore sandals or anything on your feet. And think about it. What's that? Yeah. Yes. Right, because we live too sterile a life. Right, I let my kid eat gum off the sidewalk. As a representation. Well, instead of using it as a representation. Yeah.
If my kid spat it out and ate it, I wouldn't care, but if you picked up someone else's gum.
Right. It's not the greatest thing. I'm just saying that we're too sterile with our children, right? And this is why they think there's so many allergies in North America with kids now, is because we're keeping them too far away from stuff, right? They need to get sick. That's what makes them better. Right, but yeah, you could catch this in a public shower stall. Correct. That is and when you go into long term care, if you think these are unusual photographs, they are not unusual photographs. I've seen many elderly people with nails like this. No. As I said, even with the chemicals we have, there's still no guarantee they can cure it. We still have not come up with a pure cure yet. Correct. Absolutely. I had a patient, they went to China he and his wife taught English in Korea for a number of years. On holidays, they would travel over Asia, you know, on their weeks off, whatever. And he got it in China. He was walking in his bare feet somewhere in China, and he picked it up. It wasn't as bad as this. I mean, he was getting it treated, but still his nail was discolored and a bit thick in the area and so forth. But you will come across this in long-term care. Yeah, but it's impregnated right into the keratinized cells of the nail, and that's what's causing the nail to get thick because the fungus is just discoloring and sending the nail to become thicker and thicker and thicker. Yeah. Is there a greater propensity for folks with diabetes, that kind of stuff, to get it, or does it make a difference? Yeah. Yeah, because their immune system is so low in the distal segments and all that kind of stuff, right? So, but just be aware, when you go to long-term care, be aware of this. Make sure you glove and protect yourself from it because it is contagious. It's very contagious. All right, you can go home tonight with your partners going, oh, I see your toenails. You're not coming into bed until I see your toenails. That's it. We're done with skin. So we start on the heart next week, right? We have a test next week?
Yeah.
Okay.
No,
week after. It's week after. That's right. It is next week, isn't it? I thought the test was next week. Yeah. Yeah, I thought there was a test next week. Yeah, test next week. Test number two will be next week. And then we start on the heart next week, and then we have respiratory and a couple of other things when we're done. Correct. Yep. So it'll be connective tissue, inflammation, and integumentary. Yeah, so probably about 40-ish questions or so.